works so, that's exactly what he's doing. For us, learning about e-learning, he's throwing the resources at us, he's pointing us at the knowledge, and he's allowing us to expand our horizons that go into what to go. So if you don't subscribe to OL Daily, you should be. If you're not watching Stephen's Web every day of the week, you really should be. And to let him tell you the sorts of things that he thinks e-learning is about. Please help me and welcome Stephen Daly.
I wanted to applaud after that. Okay, oh, thank you very much for welcoming me here to Cairns. I'm not a morning person. She can vouch for that. So, in the 2 minutes that I have left for my talk, no, I'm just kidding.
I gave you enough time to get you to
see. Yes, you did, and it is on. I'll just tell you now so that you know, as I'm traveling throughout Australia, I've been recording all of my talks. This one here is being recorded, thanks to this. This is a great microphone. It's made by Sony. I forget where I bought it. I bought it in Saskatoon. And it cost me about $100 Canadian. Worth every penny. It works really well. I like plugging companies who make products that work. And I'm also recording this session using free software called Audacity. And this combination has worked really well. I've recorded, how many hours? Almost 10 hours, maybe more, of talks so far. From my trip here to Australia. This will all be available on my website, downs.ca. Let me just ask, how many of you are familiar with my website? Only half. The rest of you are here on faith. I do have my website, and it's Downs, downes.ca. Don't forget the E. Everyone does. I forget where you go. You go to some place in England or something if you forget my E. Right. I don't have a screen. Usually I have slides up and things like that. So for this session, I'll be doing my slides in MIME. That'll be a little hard on the people with the microphone, but sorry, should have been here. I will add, too, that all of these talks and all of the content on my website and any software that I write is all released under open source. Basically, do with it whatever you will. If you find anything you like, feel free to reprint it, pass it on, so on. The only thing you can't do is sell it, because it's not yours. And it should belong to everybody. So everything I have is yours. Feel free to take it. There were discussions. I'm going to fling off on an aside even before I start my talk. Just around, you know, you can't make a living on free content. Free content isn't worth anything. All of my stuff is free. I believe it's worth something. And I think that there is a way that free content works. And I think part of the proof of that is I'm here. I have a job. I'm employed. I'm actually gainfully employed. It is true that I'm paid by the government, but it's not necessarily the case that I would be paid by the government. I know lots of consultants in this field who go around, people like Kurt Bonk, Jay Cross, so on and so forth, some private, some public. One of the things that characterizes them is they make their content available for free. Because it's their calling card. It's the value that they put into the marketplace. We have to understand that the market for content is changing. Back in the days of Francis Bacon, we could say knowledge is power. Knowledge isn't power anymore. Today, the network is power. Communication is power. Sharing is power. The knowledge is, I don't want to say the currency because that's the wrong word, but the knowledge is the electricity, the water that flows from node to node and makes this power possible. It's the signal in our network. So I've always promoted and continue to promote the idea of open education and open learning because the way forward, both as individuals and collectively, is to build and extend this network, to provide education, not just to the people who can afford it, but to the regions, the communities. I've spent a lot of time working in northern Canada, and I've seen the huge change that an education will make in a person's life, and it will quite literally take them from the gutter to the boardroom. I know this because I've seen it happen. And in my life, education has been the difference. It was before I did any of this stuff, I was dirt poor. After, well, I'm still dirt poor. No, I'm not dirt poor anymore. It really was the difference between being unemployable and employable. And when you look like me, you have to have the advantage of education because that's all you got going for you. Right. So I'm kind of on a theme, and the theme is distributed networks, and I've sort of been hitting that theme. This is still not the talk yet, by the way. Distributed networks, because also at the table, we were talking a little bit about what's happening in Canada, and I was mentioning a thing, and I just want to share it with the group, because I thought it was a good thing. A thing called the Community Access Program in Canada. That's something that our federal government set up, a dog's age ago. And the idea of the Community Access Project was that people in the different communities would get together, business, education, so on. The heart and soul of these little communities is the school, right? You lose the school, you lose the town. And they'd get together and they'd put together a proposal for a community access point, which is basically a computer, two computers, three computers tossed somewhere in a corner. The town library is a very common spot. The town libraries are typically like this big, the size of this room. That's what the one where I grew up was. It was about this big. That's where I read my first Arthur C. Clarke novel. It was called A Fall of Moondust. Totally irrelevant. But they'd get together, excuse me, explain how it was going to be run, explain what it was going to be used for, how it would support local business, so on and so forth, put in a proposal to the federal government, and the federal government would fund them. They funded thousands of them, maybe 10, I forget, I should know, but I don't know what the number was. Huge number of these access points all across Canada, cities, country, everywhere. Has made a huge difference. And the thing about these access points, and indeed, if you ever look at the Canadian educational system in general, the thing about the Canadian educational system is it's not centralized. These things are run locally by the community. You could try to centralize things in Canada. You wouldn't get away with it. In our country, education is a provincial responsibility. We have local school boards, and education is very much a community interest. It's really hard to make a top-down program work in our country. We are very spread out. We're very diverse. We don't always agree with each other. And we think that's the way it should be. And for us, it works. So I come from that heritage. I come from that background. Small, distributed. Communication is so important. The history of Canada is a history of communication. In the late 1800s, communication was the railway, and we had a national project to run a railway across the country. And I know you guys are familiar with that kind of thing, especially with the railway from Adelaide to Darwin opening so recently. Well, so recently, it's a few months ago now. I wanted to go on that railway, but you can't do the trip in 20 hours, or not 20 hours. I don't know, how long is that trip? Anyone know? Couple of days, yeah. I didn't have a couple of days. I also wanted to go on the Indian Pacific Railway, but that wasn't out either, so I'm flying. It'll take me 5 hours. And I'll miss all of the old bags. Well, except for a little bit that I'll get to see, but oh well. Telephone. My father was what they now call a telephone pioneer, and the job that my father did is he would travel around to these little communities, mostly in the eastern townships of Quebec, which are south and east of Montreal, and he'd be up on the pole wiring things. He'd go into people's homes and put in telephones and so on and so forth. I'm old enough, I remember party lines in these rural communities. They didn't exist in the cities while I was young, but in the little places where I lived, they existed. Marshall McLuhan, of course, is Canadian and is well known as an important theorist in the study of communication. I see myself as, to some degree, a follower of Marshall McLuhan, although Marshall McLuhan looked at technology and recoiled with horror. I look at this technology and I embrace it. And Marshall McLuhan says that the technology is the extension of the self and of the capacities of the self, and wonders if we're becoming depersonalized in the process. I look at the communication, information communication technology, as the extension of the self, the extension of the capacity of the self. And I think, look at the empowerment. Look at how much more I am now because I have this capacity to see and speak around the world. Never had that before. Even when I was young, if I wanted to talk to somebody, if I wanted to get a message across, the extent of the message, or the extent of the reach of the message, was how far I could shout. And I exercised that reach fairly frequently. I do have kind of a, well, I don't want to say anarchist background, but let's say I was a bit of a rabble-rouser. And the capacity that this new technology gives me, the empowerment, the capability to do something that even in my childhood was impossible, I think is huge. So I follow in that tradition. That tradition is very important to me. It's communication. It's the network. It's local control. It's personal empowerment. These are the things that matter to me. So I guess you'd like a talk. So I will give you my talk. I've got 30 seconds. I think I do, don't I?
No, I have half an hour.
I have half an hour. Oh, I got gobs of time. As you can see up on the screen here, the title of today's talk is A Dog's Breakfast, Roles and Responsibilities for Managers in the Cyber Era. The roles and responsibilities bit is in there because somebody promised that that's what I would talk about. The Dog's Breakfast is there because as we were driving to the University of the Sunshine Coast, I asked, well, what should I call this? And the suggestion just out of the air came, A Dog's Breakfast. Yeah, okay, that sounds good. So that's how the cyber era, that's me. So really, this is a talk about the cyber era. This is advertised as a talk for decision makers, for managers. And I guess all of you are decision makers or managers. If not, we'll just assume that you are for the day, and we can all relish in the power collectively. And this talk, for me, presented a bit of a challenge because in Canada, they're really smart. They don't let me run things. They don't let me near the places where decisions get made. Managers and me are separated by at least two walls and preferably a building. And actually in Moncton, I live in Moncton, and our administrative offices are 2 hours away in Fredericton. So I'm definitely kept out of the corridors of power. So it gives me a unique perspective on this whole concept of decision makers. Now, I do what other people do. I read management books and things like that, but that doesn't help a whole lot. So I'm looking at this and I'm thinking, well, it's a decision maker's breakfast, but the decision makers, they're the enemy. They're the other side. They're the ones that make the job hard. What am I going to say to them? No real concept. Well, of course, that's not true. But I'm not an expert in management theory, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert in management theory. Also, I'm not an expert in Australia, although I've spent quite a bit of time here, but really it's still only counted in weeks. And it'd be really foolish for me to say, well, here's what your roles are, here's what your responsibilities are, and now I realize I don't have a talk. So I'd like to thank you for... No. So I'm going to take the point of view of the person at the end of the line, which is the point of view that I always take. And some say a little facetiously, but I really am the person at the end of the line. We have organization charts, you know, government of Canada, you know, governor general, or prime minister, and cabinet, deputy ministers, assistant deputy minister, director general, right, director, group leader, secretary, me. There's nothing below me. Which is where I like to be, as odd as that sounds, because I think it's a better place to exhibit leadership. So I thought, I'm not a management person, I'm never going to be. I'm not an expert in Australia, I'm never going to be. But I do understand technology. I grew up with technology. I am what they call a digital native. Not completely. I detest and hate telephones. I won't answer my phone. I have, and they've given me an IP phone in my office, and I used to know how to use a phone. Now I don't. So I have a good excuse never to answer my phone. And all the people around the table are now turning their phones off. I don't care if you use phones. Go for it. If you find somebody more interesting to talk to during my talk than me, it's competition. It's the marketplace, right? You know, it's odd. I sometimes sound a lot like a socialist, especially the way I opened up this talk. And the irony is, when I talk about e-learning and e-learning networks and learning objects and so on, I'm pushing really hard for marketplace principles. And socialism these days is the advocacy of the marketplace. And anti-socialism these days, what they're now calling capitalism, is the advocacy of the closing and restriction of the marketplace. I find it so ironic. But I advocate for an open marketplace. But that's a later talk. So, but we can talk about that in the question. I'll leave some time for questions, just in case you have any. If not, I'll wing it. Although I'm rapidly running out of time for my talk, which I really should get to. I am probably expert in technology. I know this stuff really well. I write software as though I was writing an English essay, things like that. And I understand the internet. I live on the internet. I read about the internet. I breathe the internet. I've been on the internet since when? Since 1987. Hard to believe. So I remember the days before the web. I remember when the web was new. I remember when America Online finally opened its doors to the internet, and all these AOL newbies came rushing into the internet. It was so weird. So, and as time has gone by, I have become less and less patient with A, technology, and B, managers. That's my history. And about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, I wrote a paper, some of you may have seen it, called 9 Rules for Good Technology. Have any of you seen it? Oh, good, this will all be new. it's ironic, as with so many of my papers, it began as a post to a discussion list, a mailing list, and I just bashed the thing off, and then somebody said, well, gee, I'd really like to run that as an article if you could only write an introduction to it. So I wrote an introduction to it, and then they published it. No footnotes, no references. My academic style is what they say, a little loose. And it kept getting published. So it turned out to be a very popular paper. And it was basically an expression of my frustration at technology, because we're supposed to embrace this stuff unreservedly, without qualms. And if it's new, and especially if it's complex, it's good. And I know that that's not true. Like I mentioned, my IP telephone that now sits on my desk completely unused, because I have quite literally not a clue how to use it. And I don't see that as an advance. Now, I know there's a lot of good things about IP telephony. I know that I can now phone my own manager's office for free. It's no longer long distance, and that's a good thing. The downside is you can call me for free. That's a bad thing. I like to have a little bit of a barrier between them and me, too. I mean, this works both ways. So I put together this list of what I thought constitutes good technology. And this list still holds. I look at this list a few years later, and it's right. And now, as I was preparing for this talk in the drive on the drive to Sunshine Coast, I thought, well, these rules also apply to managers. Same principles. Because from my point of view, you notice how very carefully I've set this up. Managers are indistinguishable from technology. Managers are the things at the other end of the line. I live in the digital age. It's all data. I get a directive from on high. I get an email message from a friend. It's all the same thing. It's managers are like technology. So I thought maybe my principles for good technology might apply to managers. I figured even if they don't, and as we'll see, there's a little bit of a stretch here and there, even if they don't, nonetheless, I will have achieved the aim of getting managers, those of you who are here, to, when you're making decisions about the purchase of technology, to buy good technology rather than bad. So, you can take my management advice for what it's worth. The technological advice is sound, though. And so I do hope you keep these principles in mind when you're signing off on the purchase of technology. So, what is good technology? As I say, I have 9 rules. Good technology is, and I'm going to work, the rest of my talk is working my way through these 9 rules, and I've got 6 minutes left, so that leaves me 20 seconds a rule. I'm just kidding, but I'm going to zip through them. Anytime I say good technology is, you can substitute in your mind a good manager is. See how well the parallel holds. Good technology is always available. Now, if you think about that, think back, maybe back in the days when you were teachers and things like that, the famous equipment cart. And you know the cart that I mean, right? It's the little 4-wheel trolley that has on it, well, in my day, it had an overhead projector on it. These days, it has a digital projector on it, right? And it's available for use by teachers a week from next Friday. And that's their access to technology. That kind of organization of technology is not good technology because it's only intermittently available. It's the same way in which public transportation is frequently not good technology. In Moncton, we have a bus system. The bus arrives, get this, once every 50 minutes. Not once half an hour, not once an hour, 50 minutes. It's impossible to deal with. And that is when the bus is running, right? Of course it doesn't run Sundays or days that I actually have time to go to town. That's technology that's not always available. Good technology is always available. Good technology is like, and now I'm going to say something nice about telephones, like a telephone. It's there when you need it. It's not there, you know, 2 hours a day, 3 days a week. It's always there. Good technology is like a door. When you need a door, it's there. It doesn't go away. Imagine what our life would be if doors sometimes appeared and disappeared. How could we learn how to use them, make them efficient? Good managers are always available. They don't disappear for a week. No, of course, managers are going to go off on trips, they're going to do things, they're going to have boardrooms, they're going to play golf games, they're going to be gone. But a manager should be thinking one way or another, how can I be always available? That's rule one. That's already made the manager's job harder. And of course, let me go to the next rule, because the next rule is kind of fun. Good technology is always on. There's no state in which good technology is off. That is to say, you don't need to go through a long boot-up process for good technology. Microsoft Windows, bad technology. I'm sitting here at the start of his talk saying, stall, because I know. I turned on the computer, it's going to be a good 5 minutes before my computer starts. You imagine if you had to boot up elevators. You know, you're on the fourth floor, there's a fire, I guess you can't use the elevator in the fire. You're late for your talk in the morning, you go to the elevator, you push on the button, and there's a 5 minute boot up process while the elevator configures itself. Now, if you think about always on, now, like, by always on, I don't mean, like, always functioning. Managers can't work 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, even if they ask their staff to. I wouldn't ask them to do that. But it's ready. A street light is a great example of technology that's always on. Now, of course, the light isn't always shining, because that would be really silly in the middle of the day, but the light is there, ready to adapt to environmental conditions, and when it gets dark, the light turns on. And as it turns out, handily, the way they've set this up, if we have a solar eclipse or a big thunderstorm, the lights come on. Perfect. That's the way it should work. Good technology is always available. Now, if you take these first two things, I've probably just described the opposite of just about every manager I've ever worked with. Right? Always available, always on. Because there are always cases when, you know, you need a technology decision. Well, you know, I have the opportunity to get this, whatever, whatever. Yes, I'll think about this, and I'll give you an answer in 10 to 15 days, and you call them back and they're in a meeting. That's not good management. Managers need to be like streetlights, ready to respond and shine when it gets dark. What a metaphor. Wow. Sometimes these metaphors just emerge out of nowhere. And like, I've never used that metaphor ever in my life. Now, you might ask, well, how does technology or how does a manager accomplish those first two things? Third row. Good technology is... excuse me. And my coffee's over there, and I'm so far away from it. And as thank you, as I said in my newsletter yesterday, don't stand between me and my coffee. Good technology is always connected. That's the new age. That's the network age. Think about fire alarms. A fire alarm would not be good technology if it was not connected. Right, the whole point of a fire alarm is to register the presence of a fire and relay that message to people who need to hear about that, preferably the fire department. Now, by always connected, I don't mean something like a cog in a machine or anything like that. By always connected, I mean more like a node in a network. Good technology is in communication with... Oh, thank you so much. It's hot. Good. Now, as I experiment with drinking a coffee in front of people, watch me pour it down the front of my shirt. Good technology... Oh, no, I've lost my point. Those people listening on the tape know exactly what my point was, but I don't. Oh, yeah, it's always in communication. It's always ready to send information as relevant and to receive information. It's not cut off from the rest of the network. I've done some, looked at some studies, and it is fascinating. There's a whole new science of networks that's emerged. People like Duncan J. Watts is probably the major figure in this, but there's a book out called Nexus. There's a book out called Linked. There's a book out called The Wisdom of Crowds. And then there have been a whole slew of papers on the internet looking at networks in the workplace and what they do. Is they track the connections from person to person. Typically, they track email messages. They also track telephone calls and things like that. You look at the communications network in the workplace. It's fascinating to see. You see the person who's actually running the place, right? He's about fourth place on the hierarchy, has no authority whatsoever, no budget, but all the lines go to this person. And then you see the manager of the unit, and there's like one line. And you sort of think, well, what kind of manager is that has like one connection to the other people in their unit? And if any of my managers are listening to this, I see this even in my own organization where the managers are drifting further and further off, like a calf from an iceberg. I guess that's a bad example here. But, you know, they sort of drift off and they form their own little cluster network off in the group. And there might be one thin strand leading to the company or the organization they're actually supposed to be running. Not good management, not good technology. Technology that functions all by itself is bad technology. Someone thought it would be a smart idea to give me a tilted lectern. And this is the way this was built. And if you think about it, who built this? Who designed this? Did it not occur to them that somebody might want to put something on the surface? Thank you. Now I'll demonstrate. dropping a coffee on an upholstered chair. All right. Always available. Always on. Connected. You can see I have a very different view of management, don't I? Good technology is, and this will appeal to some of you I know already who are working on interoperability, good technology is standardized. Now, I need to be hesitant about that because there are many ways you can standardize. The kind of thing that I'm thinking about when I think about good technology, things like light bulbs. Light bulb doesn't matter who you buy it from or even where you buy it pretty well. It always plugs into the socket, right? It's a little standard. Think about batteries. I've got this microphone here, this really wonderful microphone, and I'm going to check and see if it's still working. And it is. Yay! And it's got one of those little round batteries in it. I bought it in Saskatoon. I bought a replacement battery in Utah. If this battery ran out and I lost my spare, I could go down to the shopping center here to the Tandy's and buy another battery, and it would work. That's good technology. The gasoline in cars. Imagine if you had to buy one type of gasoline if you bought a Ford and a different type of gasoline if you bought a Chevrolet. And a special imported type of gasoline if you bought a Toyota. It would be a nightmare. Now, when I talk about standardization, I need to distinguish between semantical standardization and syntactical standardization. This is a distinction people don't typically make. In fact, I think it's unique to me. That's me patting myself on the back. Bad talk or other appointment?
I've got to set up another workshop. I'll see you at the next session.
All right. Thanks. Thanks for coming out. I appreciate that. And I'll mail you the other six standards. There's an awful lot of talk about standards in our industry, interoperability standards, metadata, taxonomies, common vocabularies, and so on. Standards ought to apply only to the interface. That is, only to the way things connect, the way things fit together. Only to, in other words, the syntax. I'm very worried about ideas of standardization where everybody talks the same talk, they use the same words, they mean the same things by the same words. That's semantical standardization. And in the field of management and in the field of network theory, it's called groupthink, where you're trying to get everybody to think the same way. Not going to work. Won't work. Can't work. And if you work under the assumption that that kind of standardization will take place, it will fail. Standardization has to apply and only apply to the connections and not to the content of the information going through the network. Very important point. So, managers should manage in such a way that people know what to expect. They can interface with them. There's a good way to communicate with them and people know what that way is. But managers shouldn't go for the groupthink thing. The groupthink thing. Try to say that three times fast. The vision statement, so on and so forth. It's talking to managers, it's like I'm sharing a deep secret here. No one believes in the vision statement. I'm sorry, it's true. If you have an organization of 10 people and there's 10 people in a room, there will be 10 different reasons why those people are in that room. And organizations today, especially in the new environment, are not about the visionary at the top of the hierarchy spreading the word to the masses. It's go back to marketplace theory. It's individuals acting as autonomous agents, finding exchanges of mutual value and operating in a network. I'm at the bottom of the totem pole, but so far as power in my organization is concerned, and so far as defining the vision of my organization is concerned, as far as I'm concerned, I have as much influence as the person at the top. The person at the top has a bigger microphone, but organizations aren't run by microphone anymore.
Yeah, let's get radical in the morning.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Here we go. Good technology. Oh, wait, you can't see it. Good technology. I'll mime it. Good technology is simple. I'm not saying managers should be simple. I'm not saying that they are simple. But what I mean, and simple doesn't mean simple in function, but it means easy to operate, easy to understand. It's not complicated to work with this technology or this manager. Think about an elevator. Again, elevator, wonderful technology. Otis should be commended. I think he was. You don't use you don't read an operating manual in order to operate an elevator. You walk into the elevator pretty well anywhere in the world. You push the button that signifies the floor you want to go to, and you go to it. You're done. That's how an elevator works. Streetlights don't even press any button. They just work when they're supposed to. If technology requires a manual to use, it's broken. Think about that. If a manager sends out all kinds of directives, okay, here's how you will communicate with me, here's when our meetings are, here's the standard procedure for sending an idea up the stream, it's broken. The interface, the operation of the technology has to be simple. The people who really get this are game designers. People design electronic games because they are designing for the new generation. The new generation is what they call the Twitch generation. The new generation, including me, don't read manuals. I get new software in, I don't read the manual. The manual goes on the pile with the other manuals where it actually supports a lamp. And game designers know that they have to teach the person how to use the software as they're using software. And there's a whole science to this. If you look into this, there's a whole science to this. And they'll step you through. They'll present you with very basic functionality. Very often in these games, they present you with a training arena or something like that. And they step you through level by level. And your functionality increases as you need it, as you want it. Imagine if they designed Word that way. Word would be great. You'd start out with a blank screen you can type. And that's all you'd need to do. It'd load right in half a second. Wouldn't that be wonderful? And then if you needed paragraphs, then it would tell you how to do paragraphs. And then you would import that functionality because you need paragraphs now. And if you didn't need columns, that would never show up. It just wouldn't happen. You wouldn't be importing. You wouldn't be loading all of this. It wouldn't be in your menus. You wouldn't have to figure it out. Just try to turn it off when you accidentally turned it on. Simple. It's hard to program for simple. The people who really got simple, Google. Think of Google. The name, an input field, a button. I was asked how to design, when I was working in the field of municipal governance in Alberta. I was working very closely with the Provincial Department of Municipal Affairs, designing a website called MuniMall, which was a one-stop knowledge, learning, and information portal for the Alberta municipal sector, elected officials, so on and so forth. And they said, well, if you were designing, I thought, oh boy, if you were designing the provincial government portal, in fact, the common government portal, access to all levels of government, because they'd like to do that, right? And they're thinking, you know, like 4 columns, 20 million links. I said to them, well, I'd have a big square and a button. And at the top it would say, what would you like us to do for you? Or something like that. And you type out what you want, because we're not at voice activated yet. You type out what you want, press the button, and you get your answer. And the thing is, I'll talk a little bit more about that if you're in the afternoon sessions. We have the technology to do that now. We just don't have the desire or the will.
Because people think complicated is better, but it's not.
Good technology doesn't require parts. Think about your car. Wouldn't your car be so much better if you didn't have to put gas into it every day or so, didn't have to put oil into it, didn't have to replace the battery? Wouldn't that be better? Think about printers. Wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to replace ink cartridges? Disposable batteries. Like this microphone would be even better if it were solar powered, wouldn't it? Then I could replace the one moving part that it has and change it to zero moving parts. And I wouldn't have to worry about finding an electronic shop in Utah, where I've never been, to find this little battery. We have a new type of part in today's technology. It's the software license, right? Because software, it should be good technology. It doesn't have replaceable parts that you have to change every 6 months or whatever. So they invented one. And said, this software won't run unless you replace the license every year or whatever. All they've done, all that is a part. They've added a part. And now in order to make your software run, you have to renew your license. That's bad technology. That's technology that's broken. I have real media. I use real media to listen to my music. My real media broke, that is to say, the license expired, when I was in the airplane flying from Saskatoon to Moncton. 5-hour flight. This is minute number 15 into the flight. Bad technology. Bad technology. Bad technology. I haven't reloaded real media. I'm not going through that again. Right now I have no music player. But having no music player is better than having a music player you think you have and then it stops working 15 minutes into a 5-hour flight. It was a bit of a stretch trying to find the management one, but at the previous session, one of the parties, she said, let's replace a finger. Give blood. No. But one of the people in the session at Sunshine Coast said, well, managers that need stroking are like technology that needs parts. If you have to massage your message, always sugarcoat it. You do the groundwork before you can actually tell them anything. That's a manager that requires parts. That manager is broken. Good technology is personalized. Now, by personalized, I don't mean a registration username that you submit to a newspaper site that is of benefit only to the newspaper. Right? That's not personalization. That's, well, I have other words for it, which I won't repeat because I am being recorded. Think of the personalized technology that's really useful to you. The bank machine. Right? You want that to be personalized because you want you and only you to access your account. The telephone, you have a unique number. Imagine the telephone system with no unique phone numbers. That would be kind of interesting. And in a similar way, a good manager is personalized. A good manager is able to relate to each person as an individual, has an identity in their mind for each person, doesn't caricature, doesn't stereotype, doesn't lump everybody into one. Good technology is modular. And this is the bugbear that I have with educational technology, the way it's going today. What they're trying to do is create one big, seamless, interoperable, tightly linked system. And I'll tell you from experience, it's going to break. How do I know it's going to break? Because that's how Windows was designed, and Windows break. Technology has to be designed so that the pieces are actually a distance apart. As people like Brian Lamb and Darcy Norman and Alan Levine say, small pieces loosely joined. Right? You need to have that communication, but as soon as you tightly integrate things with Java APIs and things like that, you've broken it. You've broken it in many ways. Work of having an exchange with, who is it? Well, I'm having two exchanges. But this is with the people who are coding Blackboard. I'm writing to them. I want Blackboard to read RSS and write RSS. You know, how can I get that to happen? They said, well, you have to write a Java API. Right? You have to write a little module for an RSS feed, and then that connects into the Blackboard Java API, and that's what will work. I consider that broken. Why do I consider that broken? Well, I write my software in Perl. I don't write Java, because I think Java is an inherently flawed language. If you have to write your interface with a piece of software in the same language that software is written, it's broken. Badly broken. Managers, same sort of thing. Managers like to work as a team. Team player. Everybody works in lockstep. We're tightly integrated. We're joined at the hip. That's a broken company. Because when everybody's going into the in the same direction, if you walk off a cliff, everyone goes. Managers should think of themselves not as working in lockstep with everyone else, but as a modular part of this network, loosely connected to everyone else, bringing in information, remixing it, repurposing it, adding value to it, filtering it, and then passing it on.
So if you go over the cliff, you're on your own.
If you go over the cliff, you're on your own. Actually, it turns out these networks, they're like bungee cords. You go over the cliff, the network will pull you back. That has happened. It's happened for me on numerous occasions because I am the sort of person who goes over cliffs. Last point, because I know we're all getting antsy here because we want to get out of here and go to work. Good technology does what you want it to do. Might seem obvious, but it isn't. During my talk yesterday, I simply wanted to view the CSS behind one of the web pages I was looking at, so I clicked, put in the URL for the CSS file, expecting the CSS file to show. It launched Dreamweaver.
Does it read CSS in
Dreamweaver? It must, but that's not what I wanted. I didn't want to launch an authoring and design program. I simply wanted to view the CSS. That's why I selected View. Good technology. If I get into an airplane and the sign on the airplane says that I'm going to L.A., when I get off the airplane, I don't want to be in Paris. All right, there is such a thing as serendipity. We have an advertisement in Canada. It's quite funny, right? You know, the person gets on the plane, right, and he's the middle guy. He's just three big guys, right? And he's in the middle seat, and he's got his Hawaiian shirt, a lot like your shirt. And he's like, going to Hawaii, going to Hawaii. And there's this businessman type on each side, and he's like, going to Hawaii. And one of them looks at him, Hawaii? Not Hawaii? We're going to Winnipeg. And if you don't know Winnipeg, flatland minus 40. That's Winnipeg. We call it Winterpeg. I lived just outside Winnipeg for a while, so I can get away with that. Good managers should do what you want them to do. And they shouldn't do other things. Managers get caught up in a lot of things that have nothing to do with the unit that they're supposed to be managing. I see this over and over and over again, where the interest of the manager becomes more and more the politics at the higher level. And that becomes their priority. And the people in the unit aren't able to access the manager because the manager is at another one of these executive breakfasts or whatever. Just thought I'd throw that in. What is it that we want a manager to do? Well, we finally get to the roles and responsibilities of the manager after all. So I actually will, a few minutes after the end of my talk, get to my talk. And I submit, really, there are only two functions that a manager fulfills. And I say this as the peon at the end of the chain. Function one, communication. For me, a manager is my channel to the rest of the company. So the manager needs to communicate my thoughts and propagate them as appropriate to the rest of the company, and needs to bring in information from the rest of the company and present it to me. Communication. Second thing, provision of resources. My manager is there to help me do my job. My manager works for me. Because if you think about it, in my company, and in many other companies where you do have peons, I'm the business end of the organization. I'm the one actually making the cash. Right? I'm the factory floor, the sales department, whatever. This is where the money comes from. All the rest of the structure of the company is intended to support the person putting the parts together and getting them out the door. So when it comes to what the function of the manager is, the function is to make it as easy as possible, as efficient as possible for that person to put that thing together and get it out the door. So managers work for me. And, you know, if I worked on a factory floor and I assembled Toyotas for a living, that's what I'd be saying. I'd be saying, anything that you do that stops me from doing my job is broken management. You should be helping me do this better. So, 9 rules for good technology. Please buy good technology. The people who work for you will thank you. They'll think you're in tune and listening, even if you weren't. And maybe, just maybe, the 9 principles of good technology also apply to how management is conducted in your workplace. So that's my talk, and I'm a little over time, but we'll probably end it there, or whatever you want to do, Chris.
We have time for just a couple of questions.
Okay.
Yeah, I might be telephone.
An IP telephone. No? I think that's a good question.
It's intellectual property telephone.
Last time I was at a talk and there was this high level question, this high level question, this high level question, I asked, how do you spell? So, that's a word I hadn't heard before. IP telephone is a telephone that is connected to other telephones over the internet instead of over the usual telephone network, which is a switched network. So it sends its data in data packets rather than as analog signals.
Stephen, I just, I really sort of feel that your talk is sort of embracing something that we really need to really seriously consider, and it's just that technology can only do so much for us, and the rest of it is the people and the management and the structures that surround that. And just more and more as I sort of get more and more into this lovely world of e-learning and interoperability and whatnot, the technology part is the easy part. It's the change management, the changing roles of people, and all that meshing in between that management really plays such an important role in, that is the really crucial thing. We can buy as much software and as much technology as we want, but unless we're addressing the different work structures that people have, the awards that they work under, the way people want to work, the way people want to learn, and management is the glue that brings all of that together. Unless we've got good change management strategies and whatnot, we can throw as much as we like the technology, but it's not going to work for us. So I think this idea of your talk about management and roles is really good.
Thank you.
You just said all the things I was going to say. Thank you, so thanks, Stephen, and move on to...
And bye, everybody on the tape. It's been a pleasure not having you here today. That's all, and I hope we pass the audition.